Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
It's already mid-January.
And the temperatures are right back to where they should be for mid-January.
Yeah, well, I saw some of my friends are on islands and, like, wearing flip-flops and drinking little drinks with umbrellas, and it's very, very disturbing, very disturbing. I do want to take a moment to remind our local listeners that next Thursday, January 23rd, is the local screening for Rising from Ashes, the award-winning documentary of the story of Rwandan cycling team and its head cyclist, Adrian Nyanshuti. It's at the Cedar Lee Theater at 7 p.m.
I'll be there.
That's good. Me too. The other thing I would like to say is I would like to thank the Westerville Bicycle Club, WBC, for inviting me to speak at their annual banquet, and that will be a week from today.
That sounds exciting.
Yes, indeed. You try to figure out how I'm going to be in two places at once. So you know our little world of cycling is made up of very interesting people.
Thankfully.
Yeah, thank goodness. When I was working at the bike shop years ago, we used to try to figure out what types of folks were bike riders. You know, like many bike riders love photography, and how many bike riders belong to the NRA, those kinds of things. And we know that most bike riders are also beer drinkers.
Yes.
Yes. So when someone comes along who introduces me to something about which I know very little, I obviously need to expand my mind again to include that into the mix. Tonight I'm speaking with a most interesting gentleman from Massachusetts. He has a PhD, which is not unusual for cyclists, as we know. He is an avid cyclist, ditto, and he's an active member of the SCA. Do you know what that is?
No.
Neither did I. So I looked it up. It is the Society for Creative Anachronism. Do you know what that is?
No, but I love the title.
I know. Isn't it awesome? And I loved it so much, I had to look it up. So truth be told, I did look it up. And it is, they do reenactments in armor and
like Civil War reenactments
only before that. This
okay.
is like back in the medieval kind of reenactment.
Okay.
So it's really cool. We can add SCA to the things that bike riders like to do. Because it turns out I know somebody else who likes reenactments. And it's more Civil War, I think, for him. But he's also an avid bike rider. So right here in Northeast Ohio, I know somebody who goes to reenactments. More importantly, Eli Damon has pretty much single-handedly changed something very important for cyclists in Massachusetts. His case, Eli Damon versus the chief of police in Hadley, Massachusetts, settled with an agreement at the end of December that was handed down from a federal judge. And now Eli can freely talk about it and what it portends for riding on the road for cyclists in Massachusetts and hopefully elsewhere. I know you've been scrounging the interwebs for news, and between the two of us, I think we have some interesting items to share this evening. One is very funny. After the news, we will leave the East Coast and head on out to Missoula, Montana, and we're going to talk with the president of Adventure Cycling, Jim Sayre. Ordinarily on the go this time of year, Jim is nursing a nasty broken leg, so it was kind of easy to get him to slow down and talk to me. As the 2014 cycling season opens up, we'll find out what Jim has been up to, what the Adventure Cycling Association's direction is going to be this year, which it's sounding really, really cool. We're heading out to East Hampton, Massachusetts to talk with Eli Damon. Eli, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
You know, a lot of people were watching what went on with you, and then I got a whole bunch of, like, a flurry of messages when a resolution came about to this whole story we're going to tell. So why don't we begin with a bit of background and pick up your story in around 2005 and explain why you drive a bike as opposed to a car.
Well, the principal reason is that I'm blind. I have a rare hereditary eye disorder called retinoschisis, and my vision, you know, is not good enough that I'm allowed to drive a car.
But you can see, obviously.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And you can even read, actually, which is kind of interesting.
That's right. I mean, I can read most normal size print under the right, you know, conditions, you know, contrast and lighting and
tell us a little bit about the history of how you came to actually being confident to ride a bicycle, because you needed to depend on others for transportation.
Yeah, well, for most of my life, I had a really hard time. I didn't know how to travel in any kind of free, independent way. I relied on, relied on friends and family to give me rides, and I took the bus sometimes, and I walked or biked sometimes, but it really didn't work very well. I didn't have much of a life. And then when I was 28, I was trying to find a way to get to my choir practice, which was 15 miles away, and I had gotten a ride there before, but I couldn't get a ride anymore. And so, there weren't any buses that went there. It was a trip that I would never have felt that I could make by bike. And then I dug out this book, Effective Cycling, that I had never bothered to read before, but I thought, maybe it'll have some answers. And so the thing is, the person who gave it to me is the woman who is now my ex-wife, who's gave it to me. She didn't really know what it is, and she doesn't ride a bike, and she just thought, like, well, Eli rides a bike, and here's a book about it, and maybe I should give it to him.
Well, she sure picked the right book.
I know, and I didn't learn any of this from any of the other bike people that I know, but I read this book, and it explained to me that I could ride a bike on the roads and get the same flexibility and predictability out of the roads as people who drive motor vehicles if I just acted the same way that they did.
Right. And, essentially, and effective, like, cycling.
Exactly. And I was right. Like, wow, I mean, that's amazing. If this is true, then I can go anywhere I want to. And, I mean, it seemed kind of scary, and, I wasn't sure that it would work, and I just sort of gradually tested it out a little more and more, and I, every time I tried something new, it worked. And then, eventually I was, controlling the lane on this, four-lane divided highway that would have seemed, just impossible before.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. And so...
So as you became braver and braver and able to ride the bike farther and farther, some things started to happen in Hadley, evidently. You live in Massachusetts, I guess we should say that. And can you take us through the story of the sort of progression of what happened? And then we're going to get to the heart of our conversation here.
Yeah, I should point out for everyone who, I live in the part of Massachusetts that's not near Boston.
Okay. That's great.
There is such a part. So, I mean, as I was exploring my new freedom, I mean, every now and then I did get stopped by a police officer who said, you have to get off the road or whatever. Most of the time they would just sort of, move on and nothing would happen. And so I kind of figured, all right, well, that's just something I have to deal with. That's okay. But then I was riding through Hadley and police officer stopped me and said, it's illegal for you to ride a bike on a state highway and all this. And then he let me go. But then a month later, he stopped me again, and he seized my bicycle, and he made me walk to the police station to get it back. And he said, well, you might have been acting lawfully, but I don't care about the law.
Oh.
And, yeah.
The officer of the law who doesn't care about the law. How nice.
Yeah, exactly. Shocking to hear a police officer say that.
Yeah, right.
I became just really, just absolutely terrified, and I was afraid to to leave home without, you know, someone else with me because I, you know, because I was afraid he was going to arrest me or, you know, charge me with crimes because he had threatened to do that. And, you know, I didn't know. I was calling all kinds of people, just pleading with them to help me. And I couldn't really get any help. And I was told that basically I just had to pretend that everything was fine and just go out and just go about my business. And I wasn't, acting is not something I'm really good at, but I didn't know what else to do. And I tried making a few trips, and, you know, eventually the same police officer stopped me again. And he wrote me a ticket for a law that doesn't actually exist. But then he saw that I had a video camera on my helmet at the time, because I had seen people, make the educational, like, cycling videos, and I really wanted that too, so I got a camera. So I had this camera on my helmet, and he decided that I was wiretapping him because of the camera. and he sees the camera, and a week later I got a notice that he had charged me with disorderly conduct for controlling a lane on this highway and for wiretapping.
Wow. Did that citation carry a fine with it? Or did you have to appear in court?
Yeah, these were criminal charges. The wiretapping is a felony.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And so I had to go to court. I got a public defender because I don't have a lot of money, and prosecuted for six months, and then eventually the judge granted a motion to dismiss. He said there was no evidence of a crime here.
So they harassed you for 6 months and then just said, okay, never mind?
Well, I mean, this was the, now we're talking about the district attorney.
Okay.
They passed it off to the district attorney, and the district attorney
said there's no case
for 6 months. So then the judge said, you know, there's no crime here.
Let me take 1 second, Eli, to tell our listeners. We're speaking with Eli Damon. He is in Massachusetts and telling us the story of the Hadley Police Department and what happened to him. What year was this that you actually went through that six-month period before they threw that case out?
Oh, let me think about that. So the first two stops were in fall of 2009. This would be in the fall of 2010.
Okay, so we're already going into year four. Okay, very good. So how did you end up with an attorney by the name of Andrew Fisher? Or is there another part of the story after they threw that out that I'm missing?
Yeah, so the criminal charges were thrown out, but there was nothing. You know, I had this outstanding threats from the police against me that they thought that my traveling in the only way I knew how was illegal. They were gonna charge me with crimes, and I had no reason to believe that they weren't gonna do it again. And so I was still really terrified about that. And I found the lawyer Andrew Fisher, who specializes in bicycle law and police misconduct. So it was really perfect for this.
Perfect. How'd you find him?
I don't remember. Somebody referred me to him.
Okay.
And he agreed to help me. To help me sue the Hadley police for an injunction, an order from the court that says leave Eli alone.
Okay. Did that happen? Did you get an injunction?
I did not. That's what I was really hoping for. I got what I got was something not quite as strong, but still pretty good, which is an agreement from the town of Hadley that, you know, I had the legal right to ride a bike on Route 9 in Hadley and control the lane.
Okay, that sounds like a win.
Right. It's an enforceable contract.
Okay.
And that's what happened recently is that agreement, which ended the lawsuit.
That was the end of the lawsuit, but there was a decision that got handed down from another court.
That's right. So during the lawsuit, we filed for summary judgment. When you go to a trial and you have a jury decide something, that the jury is supposed to decide on the facts. But if the case doesn't rest on the facts, if it just rests on an interpretation of the law, then you don't need a trial. Then you do what you file for, it's called summary judgment. You ask the judge, like, look, here are these facts that we agree on, and we just need you to interpret the law.
Okay.
And so we filed for summary judgment, and the defense also filed for summary judgment.
What did they want? Time.
Well, they wanted all the charges. They wanted all the, you know, all the civil rights claims to be thrown out.
Okay.
And the judge threw out some of the civil rights claims, and you know the others he said could be determined at a trial. But in that he also said, you know, that, you know, that there is a legal right to ride a bicycle on Route 9, and he said, you know, a slower moving bicyclist must pull to the right to allow faster moving motorists to pass when it is safe to do so under the conditions and or under the circumstances. And the important thing about that is that, one, right, the cyclist doesn't have to be to the right by default. They only have to do it to allow someone to pass. And it might be, it acknowledges it might not be safe to move over and let someone pass, and that the cyclist doesn't have to do that if it's not safe. And so even though it looks like a restriction on cyclists, it's actually an affirmation of the rights of cyclists. And this is the first federal case that involves cyclists' right to the road. And this is the most authoritative affirmation of cyclists' right to the road that we've ever gotten in this country.
So this actually came down from a federal judge. So it bypassed the Hadley police and went to a different, like a circuit court, up to a federal court. And now this judge handed down this decision, this summary judgment that says cyclists absolutely have a right to the road. And this is the first time a federal case has done that. So you have a precedent-setting case, it looks like.
It's not a formal legal precedent. It's only in district court, but it's definitely sets a informal precedent and a kind of social, you know, precedent. I mean, this has not happened before. There's not been this authoritative of an affirmation.
Could somebody in another district use this as sort of evidence that there's a change in thinking, at least even if it's just in Hadley or in Massachusetts or even at a federal level, there's a change of thinking, even if it's not a change of law?
It certainly could be, and it will be. My lawyer and his partner told me that they plan to cite this case in the future.
Oh, good. Now, part of the agreement was having your legal fees paid, which was kind of cool.
That's right, yeah. My lawyer agreed that I wouldn't have to pay him, that he would only get paid if it came from the town. And the town did end up paying him, you know, not what his full fee would have been, but enough that he was satisfied.
That's pretty cool. So how have things changed for you? How are you doing? Is your confidence back? Are they treating you better? Of course, now we're in the middle of winter, but are they treating you better?
Well, it's hard to tell. I think that they were treating me better while the case was pending, too, because anything they did, the judge would have found out.
And they didn't know what the outcome was going to be.
Right. And this makes it more permanent. And yeah, I do feel a lot better. I feel more free to travel wherever I want to. And also now one of the toughest things was that I was, while the case was going on, I couldn't talk about it.
Right, right. You had to wait
until that was very difficult because it was pretty much the only thing that was going on, and it was very hard for me to not be able to talk about it.
I have to say, I like the fact that you were able to persevere and be able to get an attorney who not only understood your case, but could take it to where it needed to go to get it resolved. I think it's been a win-win. I just hope that police departments begin to look at this and say, well, there needs to be a sea change. I know that you went to the colloquium down in Florida, right?
I did, yes.
We talked to Mike Wilson last year, and Carrie and I are really good friends. So, you know, I know about IM Traffic, and are you thinking of perhaps taking the IM Traffic course to start teaching it? Is that in your future, maybe?
I mean, I am a cycling savvy instructor.
Oh, you are? Good for you.
Yeah,
good for you.
And I've taught two classes so far in Portland, Maine, and I expect to start teaching them locally this spring. And yeah, I'm very excited about IM Traffic, and I've contributed some stuff to the website.
Yes, if anybody's interested, your story is on the IM Traffic website, and it's fairly complete from start to finish, and it's a really interesting story. There are some details, obviously, that we had to leave out in our conversation today, but there's some really good details about, you know, some of the trips you made and some of the things that happened with the police. I'm really glad you were able to persevere and not have to kind of shrink back and not get this resolved. I think it's awesome that you got it resolved.
Yeah, thanks. I'm very, very relieved.
Well, I appreciate you talking to me about it. Again, if anybody wants to see Eli's story, it is on the iamtraffic.org. And the story is interesting. I wish you a lot of luck, and thank you so much for talking to me this evening.
Oh, thank you.
All right. You have a good night.
All right.
Thanks. Bye. Bye-bye. Eli Damon joined me from his home in East Hampton, Massachusetts. He doesn't talk like he's from Boston, does he?
No, he doesn't.
No. He actually has a PhD. He's a very bright guy. Very bright guy. And really, he went through some crap, pardon my expression.
A lot of perseverance.
Really. I have to give him a lot of credit because he said he was very timid about traveling without somebody helping him all his life. So good for him. Want to do some news?
Sure.
We have some good stuff in the news today. And should we start with that story, that funny story?
Whichever you'd like. That would be fun.
All right. This is the story of the week, and I'm letting Tim do it. Go ahead.
Well, we sort of titled this one as the Irish, not election, but erection.
That's correct.
Irish racing cyclist left with 7-week erection after fall onto crossbar was cured in a Dublin hospital. So a mountain biker who fell astride under the crossbar was left with a freak injury that resulted in a permanent erection for 7 weeks before a Dublin hospital was finally able to cure the problem, which they eventually did. But what we've talked about is, one, he waited 5 weeks till he went to the hospital.
So what was he doing for those 5 weeks? Yes.
Well, I'm not sure what he was doing, but, you know, most guys can imagine what he was trying to do.
Right.
And then the other interesting part of this, for those of you thinking you might want to try this, when those treating the patient reviewed medical literature and for similar cases, they could only find 2 incidents where this has happened before. So don't go out and try that tonight.
Chances are you won't be able to recreate it.
Yes, you're going to do a lot more damage than what you think might happen. But
7 weeks, huh?
7 weeks is...
I'm glad I'm not his girlfriend.
Long time.
Yeah, right. as we expected, Shimano's Di2 wireless transmitter was spotted this past week, and VeloNews' Kali Fretz reported this on Wednesday. Shimano's electric Di2 drivetrains will soon be able to communicate wirelessly with external devices. using a small ANT protocol transmitter that sits in line with the current E-tube wiring. The company informally unveiled the new device at its European headquarters on Tuesday, along with a compatible computer from its component brand, Pro. Official information is scarce, pending an official release next month, but a quick run through the functions of the compatible cycling computer revealed the ability to display current gear selection and battery levels. A similar device, shown at Interbike this year, hid the ANT transmitter inside a DI2 shifter. The version on display this week places the transmitter inside a small black box, which can be connected anywhere within Shimano's E-tube wiring system. So I think that's interesting. ANT protocol is what a lot of people use now, along with Bluetooth and all that, to get things wirelessly done. What else you got?
Well, we can continue on with the contraptions bolted onto bikes and cycle generating. We have the story about the bicycle desk that generates electricity.
I saw it. It is really cool. Did you watch the video?
I watched the video, and it's a really cool setup. It's a lot of people are doing the stand-up desks, the treadmill desks,
right,
and other things. And Pedal Power is the company based in Essex, New York. And what they've done is another Kickstarter campaign, which is fabulous. We love to see those. And they actually were looking for a $10,000 goal, and they made it over $30,000. Basically, it's a metal frame that you sit at, and you can sit at your desk, and you pedal to create the power for everything that you need. In the video, you have to see it.
It powered a blender.
Yes, and they were actually chopping a log with a log splitter was one of the things that they had.
So, yeah, I think that's a little, then you'd have to wear eyewear and do all kinds of stuff.
What was interesting is it's a little bit noisy, but it is generating a lot of power from that will do for your computer, anything else you need. They're also working on making it a little bit more quiet. Instead of using the metal chain, they're going to use some other version of belt drive or whatever that is. And they actually mentioned a spin class, SoulCycle, which is in New York, which could be part of another story that we'll have, that imagine all the power you could generate with spinning classes and everything else that goes with that. So
very cool. Very cool. So what do you know what the name of the Kickstarter campaign was?
It was just Pedal Power.
Oh, Pedal Power.
Yep.
Okay. Very cool. Well, Road Bike Action Magazine took a video tour inside of the Faster Wind Tunnel this week. And they reported online for an upcoming April issue of Road Bike Action that they were going to go all in with an aero, A-E-R-O theme, by looking at how different types of bikes react to the wind. They took a two-pronged approach. One was to head to the velodrome to see what Alpha Mantis had up their sleeves with their latest track aero system approach to improving riders' drag numbers in the wind. As you might remember, when we talked to Patrick Brady about what was new for 2014, he said the way to get faster is going to be about aerodynamics. So for chasing down more traditional aero methodology, they headed to Scottsdale, Arizona, to one of the most complete bike shops on the planet. And I thought this was interesting because we had a lot of discussion about bike shops looking for new ways to be innovative so as to compete with internet sales. Well, Faster Bikes, the brainchild of James Kramer, himself somewhat obsessed with going fast on a bike, and in addition to having first-rate fit studios on the premises, installed a fully functioning wind tunnel that is open to anyone looking to chase their own numbers just like the pro riders do. To quote James, "I know from my own personal experience how much benefit a wind tunnel can provide a serious cyclist, but getting access to the San Diego tunnel is not easy, and they charge $1,000 an hour. Our goal with installing a wind tunnel at the bike shop was to make the experience and the information much more accessible to everyone. We have two on-site fit labs that offer 2D and 3D film capture, and they give very reasonable prices to use those facilities of the rider on the bike, an optimization package that includes an hour in the wind tunnel, also for about 40% less than the $1,000 an hour that San Diego is charging. You can watch their video at roadbikeaction.com and just say, take a video tour inside the Faster Wind Tunnel.
I think that's really interesting. And a lot of that is what I would be interested in is all the data they're going to collect and make it that much easier for the normal person, what's going to work and what won't work.
Yep.
And I just recently heard a story on the speed skaters in the Olympics. the suits that they're wearing, how they're changing and everything that they're doing with that, putting them into a wind tunnel. And imagine how much faster a cyclist goes. The aero is that much more important for something like...
Well, I think it was Mark Phillips, like two Olympics ago, all those suits changed. And that had to do with the aerodynamics in the water.
Exactly.
Yep, exactly. What else you got?
We've got two stories about riding on the streets. One is from Saskatoon, a cycling program where it seems like there's no consulting with any cyclist or anything, and the public officials are simply deciding that they want to do this and that and the other, and there's no communication between anyone, and there's a case where it's probably not going to work. They're making bike corridors that have no connection to anything else. They don't come out anywhere, but they say, we have a bike corridor.
I see.
And then...
It's bad planning 101.
No planning.
No planning 101. Okay.
And then we've got in Calgary, we have the bike report that there's a spike in number of bike trips into downtown since what they call their cycle track opened up. A specific area, a separated bike lane on 7th Street Southwest, bike ridership increased 430% once they put that in. And they're looking to expand that. They're looking to do more. The main thing they're trying to do is see if they can make up some more space, take a little bit off of the sidewalk, and just kind of work together with everything on that. And there's a case where the cooperation seems to work well.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, my last item this evening is about an event. We haven't reported on a tandem event in a long time. And as we say, the early bird, yada, yada, you know, catches whatever. Canada Wins. We are going to talk about their event this year. First, the Canadian Tandem Rally will take place from May 24th through 27th in Niagara, Ontario, Canada, which isn't too far from us. This year's event includes breakfasts, dinners, wine tasting, and even a battle reenactment if you want to attend. The event is sponsored by MBS Tandems of Canada, the Ontario Cycling Association, KHS Bicycles, and Arkell Overdesigns. For more information, you can log on to mbstandems.com. Registration is not open yet, but will open shortly.
Last thing that I'll have is just a quick update on Rob Jones, who we've talked about before.
Yes, yes.
His latest blog update after day 95 is Hello Kansas. So he's made it to Kansas so far.
Nice. I wonder what the weather's like in Kansas.
Probably a little warmer than the Northeast, what we have now.
Oh, it's pretty cold here.
And then this is one that we talked about before. Cyclists are more intelligent, charitable, and cool than the average person, a study says.
Okay, whose study is this? Remember, you can skew statistics.
Well, this actually came from the scientist over at Mind Lab.
Okay.
And they just studied the brain and how it reacted, not just simple verbal responses from people. And almost half, 48% of the people said they were more attracted to sports people than celebrities. 63% of the subjects also confessed their love of the stretchy material Lycra.
These are great comments.
They are great comments, but really, well, here's another one. Nearly a quarter of the people in the study said they would prefer to date a cyclist over other sporting people. Just interesting, fun little study, and we knew all of this anyway.
Because cyclists are cool.
Of course.
Of course. All right. I think that's all the news that's fit to talk about. We are going to take a break here, and we'll be back to talk with Jim Sayre from the Adventure Cycling Association. We'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
On Thursday, January 23rd at 7 p.m., the Cedar Lee Theater will present a benefit screening of Rising from Ashes, an uplifting independent film chronicling the rise of the Rwanda national cycling team in 2006, as that nation grappled with the legacy of its genocidal conflict in the 1990s. This special event is co-sponsored by and will benefit the Heights Bicycle Coalition and Bike Cleveland. Tickets and more information in the events calendar at bikecleveland.org.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist at WJCU. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And we are going to head out to Missoula, Montana. I always wanted to go to Missoula, Montana.
Let's go. Let's make a road trip and do a simulcast, whatever they call
simulcast,
that.
Simulcast, that's good. Remote broadcast?
Yes,
yes,
a remote.
That would be fun. That would be fun. Well, let's go talk with the president of Adventure Cycling, Jim Sayer. He is joining me from his office in Missoula. Jim, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Hey, it's good to be here. Thanks, Anne.
Yeah, probably for you it's good to be anywhere, huh?
Oh, it's always good to talk to friends.
Yeah, exactly. So we did speak with Mike Demme at the Interbike and learned something new about what was going on with the publication at Adventure Cycling. But I wanted to get an update from you about what's on tap for 2014. There's always so much new stuff going on with AC. I want to start with something called Best Practices for State Park Campgrounds. I was kind of perusing your website and saw that. Tell us about that and why you're looking at reaching out to the state parks.
Well, let me first say that we do have a wide variety of offerings. Our mission at Adventure Cycling is to inspire and empower people to travel by bicycle, but we do that in a wide variety of ways, from the magazine and Adventure Cyclist that Mike Demme publishes for us. He's an awesome editor. To our brand new website, which just got updated about the same time and is a great resource for anybody interested in bike travel. But what we do is, as a nonprofit, we take all of our net proceeds and we funnel them into doing good things for biking and for bike travel around North America. And so what you're probably referring to is a recent blog post on best practices for state park campgrounds. And so we do a lot of things, from working to help create an official U.S. bicycle route system. We just signed a memorandum of understanding this year with the National Park Service on how to improve biking to and through the national parks. And believe me, that gets a lot of feedback. And then, but also with state parks, because they're everywhere. There's way more state parks than there are national parks. And oftentimes, they're great places for a traveling cyclist to stop. And so some states have actual policies that say, like Virginia or Oregon, that say, we will never turn away a traveling cyclist. If you get here, no matter whether our campground is officially full or not, you will be able to stay here. We'll find a way. And then also, as some people know, there are places with biker-hiker campsites where they're specifically dedicated to the traveling cyclist. And those are fantastic. I've used those up and down the Pacific Coast and in other parts of the country. So what we've done is created a best practices checklist for state parks and how they can better serve traveling cyclists. And we're also working with local groups and state groups to try and encourage them to make sure that they can promote this too. So now they have a handy checklist if a state park says, how can we do better? So you can go on our blog right now on the website at adventurecycling.org, and it's one of our most recent blog posts. And then we also have on our website a whole page on building bike tourism, both for businesses and for agencies, on how you can improve bike tourism opportunities.
Let me ask a question that didn't occur to me before. Are there any state parks or even, well, I don't want to go to the National Park Service because we've talked with them and they have some new policies about cycling that are pro-cycling. But are there any state parks that are sort of down on cyclists that don't necessarily welcome cyclists to come in and camp or even ride through?
I don't know if there are any that are deliberately antagonistic or overtly antagonistic.
Okay.
But there are definitely some that are stronger than others. As I mentioned, Virginia, California is pretty good. Oregon, Washington State, so the coast, West Coast does well. But again, I'd say take a look at that list and the blog post because it'll give you a good understanding of which state parks are doing better than others.
Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, we have a wonderful state park not too far from us called Punderson, and I know they have lots of camping, they have cabins, and they have all kinds of stuff. And it never occurred to me that somebody might get turned away.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, well, because, of course, being the princess that I am, I prefer not to sleep on the ground anymore. I'm getting too old. So,
well, also, I'll say the other cool thing that's happening is our great program staff, we now have two people working full-time on this, plus I do some time, and we have a lot of volunteers around the country. But Ginny Sullivan is our travel initiatives director, so
right.
Knows her associate. She's at the Oklahoma Bike Summit right now. Ginny just came back from D.C. We are working with a State Parks Director Association, and there is such a thing, and we're trying to get that onto their agenda. Again, it's a great way to disseminate best practices across this full network of state park directors.
Sure.
So some of them, it just doesn't even occur to them that this is an issue because mostly they're dealing with cars, right? But I think that's going to be another great entree, and giving them this list of best practices is going to be a real help.
So at the beginning of our conversation, you talked about funneling profits into specific programs. And I have to say, there are not a lot of organizations that seem to exceed their fundraising goals. But your holiday fundraising campaign did just that. Why do you think it was so successful?
Because we have awesome members. We
really
do.
True.
I mean, we joke internally about member love, but we've increased our membership every year the last few years, which is kind of amazing, both because nonprofits in general can have issues with getting members, and we just came out of the Great Recession. And then we've done a lot more work to try and raise donations. Part of it is people are really excited by the wide variety of things we do. They love the magazine. They love the maps we produce. And I know we'll talk about that a little. And they love the fact that we do advocacy. So it's almost like gravy. You know, they get all this good stuff to inspire them to travel by bike or help them. But then also they get, you know, this advocacy group that works on everything from chip seal to, you know, the national scene. So this year, we also, for the first time, were able to get $100,000 from about 10 donors as a pledge match fund. And then that sparked a number of people to give because they saw the match and they thought, that's really cool. So I think we raised another $187,000 beyond that. So that was a record for us for our holiday campaign. So $287,000 total.
Wow. Let me ask you a question about these 10 donors, and I don't really care who they are. What I'm really interested in is, were any of them outside of the regular, what we would call the bicycle industry network?
Oh, all of them were. They're all individuals.
That's so cool.
No, we get hardly anything from the bike industry, which is
pathetic.
Yeah, well, I won't say that. I think the one thing we've done poorly at Adventure Cycling is educate the bike industry. And I take full blame for it because I've been the director for 9 years. And I go to the executive or the conferences for the executives in the bike industry.
Uh-huh.
I think they still see us as this tiny niche. And I tell them, you know, we're the largest bike membership organization in North America. We have extremely passionate members. Our member surveys show that they don't just travel by bike. They commute. They do recreational cycling. They oftentimes have four or five bikes. They're really affluent. They're well-educated. And I think you're missing the boat because I think it's really hard to even get the major bike companies to advertise in our magazine, even though I think it's now number two in print circulation after bicycling. I know we surpassed Velo News. And but there's just much more of a focus on day riding, mountain biking, and racing. So you know, we just need to do better. But all our major donors are individuals.
Wow.
We have gotten
Holy
some
smokes.
Support from SRAM Cycling Fund, which has been fantastic. We just got a new grant in support of our national work, and we're really grateful to them. But that's about it. There are bike companies and accessory companies that definitely advertise in the magazine. And
right.
Increasingly, they are coming on as business members, like QBP, Blackburn just came on, Bike Tours Direct, which is a bike tour brokerage company, came on as at really high levels, our highest level for membership. So it's happening. It's just slow. But we are grateful to our members. They are amazing, and they have been increasingly supportive.
I don't want to belabor the point, but I want to just say one more thing about the bicycle industry and the bicycle touring industry, which seem to keep separate and distinct sort of organizations going. You know, we used to encourage bicycle touring companies to come into the shop once a year, and we did something called a bicycle touring open house.
Oh, nice.
To get people to understand that bicycle touring is as good a vacation, if not better, than anything you could possibly do. And I've always wondered why, and it's sort of one of those rhetorical questions, why the bicycle industry itself, the Treks, the SRAMs, the Specialized, didn't embrace the bicycle touring part of the work and bring them into places like Interbike and give them their own pavilion. You know, I've always wondered that. So I just thought I'd put that out there just in case.
No, and let me say that. We have been working closely with the major events that hold an annual conference, the Bragg Brides and Ride the Rockies, all those great events. And they've changed their name, actually. I've been working with them for the last few years, and the league has too. But to try and broaden the scope of this group, it used to be called the National Bike Tour Directors Association.
Right.
And now they've called themselves the Bicycle Tour Network. And The next conference is in November in San Diego, and we're actually working, Jerry Norquist, who started, was one of the founders of Cycle Oregon.
Right.
And I, and others are working to try and make this a broader kind of conference to include all the different elements of bike tourism, because it's the multi-day tour operators, it's the events, it's the charity rides. But also what they found in Europe is that three-quarters of the revenue that comes from bike tourism are for day trips. You know, so people will go on vacation for a week, but they will spend a day or two on a bike.
Right.
And that is bike tourism.
Sure it is.
And I've tried to also convey that to the bike industry that, you know, don't just think of it as the cross-country people or the multi-day tours. It's also now increasingly, you know, day rentals like, you know, Bike and Roll in many cities around the country, or, you know, bike share is increasingly going to be used by tourists. They found that in Washington, D.C. with Capital Bike Share. So I'm hoping we're going to be able to pull a lot of those folks together and destinations, you know, because they want to be the bike tourism destination. So when you go on our website and look at that building bike tourism page, we've also provided best practices for those folks, too. So I think we're going to see more and more folks interested in bike tourism in the industries and just as individuals.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jim Sayre. He's the president of the Adventure Cycling Association. I want to talk a little bit about what really may put AC on the map, so to speak,
okay.
And that is your mapping system.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, it is somewhat the heart of the organization. I guess it all started with the bike centennial back in 1976. But what's happening? There are new things happening in mapping. What's going on? I know there's a lot of GPS stuff and there's a lot of, you know, small apps and stuff like that. What's happening with adventure cycling and maps?
There's a lot. Well, we have 5 full-time cartographers now on staff.
Wow.
You know, our staff has grown in the last 8 years from 20 to 36, and part of that growth has been having another couple of cartographers, and increasingly we're bringing on cartographers that are more savvy in the ways of 21st century mapping. But yeah, we started with a Transamerica Trail that's from Yorktown, Virginia to Astoria, Oregon, 4,200 miles, and it's grown to 41,420 miles of routes all over North America, mostly paved and trail, but we also have created the longest mapped mountain bike route in the world, and that's the Great Divide. And that runs from Banff National Park down to the New Mexico-Mexico border. So part of what we do is just having to update those maps. I mean, we really want to make sure that our information is accurate. We've also created social media tools like Twitter hashtags for our major routes so people can share, you know, up-to-date information about what they're seeing on routes. But updating those maps is enormously time-consuming. And, you know, what's interesting is people say, well, why not just use Google or some other service? And to be honest, our stuff is almost always more up-to-date than anything you'll find on the web because we have the best resource, which is the people using the routes, and they're constantly
right.
giving us feedback. So we are always updating. We're actually translating a lot of our existing maps, our older maps, into a geographic information system format. So they'll be geocoded, geo-referenced. That's all happening. And then we're creating new routes, which we love, and our members really anticipate. So the newest one's going to come out next month. It's called the Idaho Hot Springs Mountain Bike Route, and it is going to be fantastic. It's a 600-mile route in central Idaho, mostly on gravel roads with 4 single-track offshoots. It's going to go past 50-plus hot springs, developed and primitive, so it's going to be amazing. It goes through some really cool areas near Sun Valley. There's a little annex to Boise. You can go right to the airport if you're from out of the state and you want to fly in. And then it's just going to have loads of features. It goes through wilderness areas that are just fantastically beautiful. And then we're going to finish up our work at the end of this year on Bicycle Route 66 from L.A. to Chicago, which a lot of people are anticipating.
Yeah, you just answered my next question.
Yeah, L.A. to Chicago or vice versa. And we've done a ton of research, and we're going to have that ready and to go at the start of the coming calendar year. And that's going to fill a big void in our overall system. So we're also beginning to look at what our next longer route will be and our next shorter route. So concurrently, we're updating our existing route system, and we're making technical improvements. And finally, we're also going to be beta testing some digital apps for mobile devices, because that's been a constant bit of feedback we've gotten is, you know, we love your paper maps, but could you do something else in that? We do offer the GPS waypoints online, but this will be, I think, a better way to go for those who want to use their tablets or their phones. So we're going to beta test those this year, and we're working with our team on that right now.
One of the other things I noticed in browsing the website again before we had our conversation was that people passing through Missoula get sort of this special treatment from the Adventure Cycling Association when they come by on their bikes.
Tell them
what they get. It made me actually think while I was in the shower this morning going, I wonder if we should go to Missoula just so we could get this.
Yeah, no cheating either. Well, I know. This is for people that bike to Missoula.
I know.
So you can't just like park your car 5 miles out.
And ride the tandem in. Okay.
Spray bottle yourself and then pretend to have come from Virginia. But no, we get usually on the average of about 1,200 people that cycle into our offices during business hours. During spring, summer, fall, and it's fantastic. We really want them to come visit us because it motivates us. We get to meet all these incredible people, and you can see them online. In fact, one of our staff did this terrific 2-minute video that shows you all the photographs of people who came through this last year, and you can see on our Flickr feed, too, all these people, and they are from all over the world. And so we take their pictures that goes on the Wall of Fame, which is right in the front of our office as you come in, and we archive those if you ever want to see them again, put them online. We provide free sodas and ice cream. We have a cyclist lounge where people can hang out. And as we said, we train our staff to, I don't know if we quite go to this level, but, you know, kind of ooh and ah when they come in, you know, because, you know, they've just made this major journey. And Missoula is not exactly a major metropolitan area. It takes a lot to get to our place. So we appreciate it, and we just love having visitors. And we feature them in our magazine, too, oftentimes. So we do treat them like rock stars.
They are rock stars.
They are.
You know, riding bikes long distances makes them rock stars in my book.
Exactly.
So the last thing I want to talk about is traveling with your bike. A couple of things are going on. One, we talked with Tim Bowden, who took the sort of beta testing that they're doing on the Capital Limited out of Washington to New York, where they're putting some new bike racks on. And I know you do a lot of work with multimodal transportation for cyclists. What's going on that you're involved in? And then the last thing is about, you know, why it costs so much money to take your bike on a plane. And are there any plans to, you know, do something to sort of petition these airlines that bicycles and golf clubs are not so different from one another?
So overall, I will say yes. So progress on trains, not so much progress on planes.
Right.
As you've heard, there have been a few pilot projects, including on the Capital Limited, which runs from Chicago to D.C. and actually runs parallel to one of the best cycling opportunities, the Great Allegheny Passage and CNO Canal Towpath between Pittsburgh and D.C. And we've actually been involved in that, along with local and state groups, along with Tom Bowden. And then also, we have been really pushing Amtrak to get more systematic. So one of our volunteers, he's really like a staff person, but a retired executive, Kerry Irons, has done a great job of compiling information about Amtrak and bike availability, and we're going to make that information available. But also, Amtrak is committed now to doing a bike advisory committee, which is a long time coming, and I really want to credit our staff for making this possible, working with Amtrak. About how we can make conditions better across the whole system. And that's about to launch. So that'll be a mix of Amtrak people and bike advocates and users. So that's going to happen soon. And we're beginning to see them look at more pilot projects for roll-on, roll-off service like Capital Limited, like the Ethan Allen line that serves upstate New York and Vermont. We're also seeing some political actors like Senator Chuck Schumer from New York who've really been pushing to try and get them to experiment with us and asking, why can't we have more bikes on trains? So I'm feeling very positive about Amtrak and other rail services right now. And again, we're bringing economic impact surveys from states that we also work on to demonstrate how this could be really lucrative for train systems. On the plane side, not so much. It's still expensive, it's still a hassle, and it's still highly arbitrary. There are a few airlines like Frontier Airlines that are very positive. And I'll tell you that actually their operations director is a member of Adventure Cycling and one of our tour leaders. So
that's
totally
nice.
Gets it.
Sure.
It is. But what's interesting is then he'll tell us where the airlines are coming from as to why they see bicycles as different than golf clubs. And sometimes, again, we scratch our heads. But there are a few things where they say, sometimes You know, they've got a big cardboard box. It gets left in the rain a little bit. It starts to disintegrate. There are people that will pack their boxes wrongly so the pedals aren't taken off, and they'll pop out, and they'll scrape a worker, or they'll rub up against other luggage. And so he says, you know, he can be ambivalent himself. He understands why this would be a great thing, but he also says that, you know, there are issues coming from the airline. So I feel like we're going to have to get a way to be more systematic with the airlines, too. I mean, I think we're making progress with Amtrak, both on specific routes and systematically, and I think we need to do more with the airlines because we've been kind of fighting a losing battle there for a while.
Well, I think that on airlines, you need to pack the bike in a predictable way. So, you know, it's either one of the CrateWorks boxes or one of the iron cases or someplace where you don't have those issues of dissolving cardboard or pieces and parts popping out. But, you know, on the Amtrak, they're making it so they have racks where you can actually hang your bike. So I can see for the first time where the airlines are coming from. But, you know, when a bike is packed well, like to go overseas, or if it's a tandem or one of the S&S bikes where it's in a really nice case, you know.
Yeah, the analogy I see is with the scofflaw cyclist. You know, we always hear about the guy that or gal that runs the red light or
right, exactly.
You know, rides on the sidewalk or something, and that's what sticks in people's craw.
Of course.
And then the bad apples, you know, in terms of packing their bikes or doing something wrong, you know, that's what's going to stick in the mind. So they're going to say, okay, if they're going to do this, we're going to make them pay for it. And so I think, you know, I think there's an opportunity there, and it may take a little while, but I agree with everybody who says this cuts across all cycling categories, whether they're day riders or tourists or whatever. Just that ability to take your bike and your own bike versus renting a bike at the other end, it would be a great boon to all of us.
So unfortunately, we are running out of time. And, you know, I mean, we could probably talk about cycling all day. I know you are nursing a broken leg. I hope you're back on your feet, both of them, soon. And I'll see you probably at the summit. You coming to the summit?
I'll be at the National Bike Summit. Encourage everybody to be there. We'll have some different sessions on Amtrak and some other things that are related to bike tourism. So that'll be part of the mix, too.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today, Jim Sayre, Adventure Cycling Association. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Thanks, Anne.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Jim Sayre joined me from his office in Missoula, Montana. I hope that leg of his heals up fast. So before we sign off this evening, I'd like to invite all listeners in the Columbus, Westerville, Ohio area to come to the Westerville Bicycling Club's annual banquet next Saturday night. I will be in two places at once, obviously, here and there. I can do that.
Yes, you're very talented. You
yes,
can do
I
that.
Am. I'm honored that they asked me to be their guest speaker, and I will need all the support I can get. So if you listen to the show and you are in that area, you can find out more about the banquet at the Westerville Bicycle Club website. That's it for us tonight. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks again, Tim, for some great news stories.
It was fun.
Yes, it was. Don't forget to visit us on Facebook. We're on Twitter at Outspoken Cyclist without the E. Hope your week is warm and sunny. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.